Now, you probably come in with some preconceptions about what corporate finance is all about, and I could feed into those preconceptions, but I don't want to. In fact, I'm going to start off with something strange. I'm going to start off by specifying what I think corporate finance is not about. It's not about accounting statements and ratios. It's not a glorified accounting class. It's not about what consulting firms and investment banks call corporate finance, because that to me is a very narrow slice of corporate finance. It's about how companies deal with financial markets. And it's not about doing bad things, because in the vision of some people at least, corporate finance is bad people doing bad things to good companies and good people, and that's not what I think corporate finance is all about either. So now that I've told you what corporate finance is not about, I think I should tell you what I think corporate finance is about. Corporate finance is about every decision that a company makes that involves the use of money. In fact, let me take back that word. It's not about what companies do, it's about what every business has to do, from the smallest to the largest. Every decision that involves the use of money is a corporate finance decision, which is a little self-serving, because I've just defined everything that companies do, everything that businesses do, to be corporate finance. In fact, I remember being asked to give an intro talk to an MBA class, and I told them that everything they would be doing during their MBA was really an extension of basic corporate finance, from marketing to strategy to operations. They're all corporate finance decisions. So my vision of corporate finance is a really broad one. And in a sense, every business has to make basic corporate financial decisions. In fact, I think the place to start with the kind of vision that corporate finance brings to the picture is the balance sheet. And in fact, let me start off with a conventional accounting balance sheet, which many of you might be familiar with. In a conventional accounting balance sheet, you are constrained by accounting rules. And think of how many rules there are. Thousands of FASB rules, accounting standard rules that govern how a balance sheet is set up. So on the asset side, you break assets down into whether they're tangible or intangible, whether they're short-term or long-term, whether they're financial or non-financial. But if there are a dozen categorizations of assets. I've kind of listed out four: fixed assets being long-term assets, current assets like inventory, accounts receivable being short-term assets, investments in other companies, stocks and bonds being financial assets, and what accountants euphemistically call intangible assets, but the most critical of which happens to be goodwill, which is not an asset at all. It's a plug variable. On the other side of the balance sheet, accountants again slice and dice your liabilities up into different categories. You have long-term debt, you have short-term debt, you have non-interest-bearing debt, you have interest-bearing debt, and you also have the accountant's estimate of what equity is worth, which the book value of equity effectively measures what the accountant thinks the equity in your company is worth. That's a conventional accounting balance sheet. Here's a financial balance sheet. In some sense, a financial balance sheet is far simpler than an accounting balance sheet. In another sense, it's far more complex. If you look at the assets out of a financial balance sheet, there are only two categories: investments you've already made and investments you yet to make. Now, that's a kind of scary thought that I'm giving you credit for investments yet to make. But when you think about investing in a growth company, much of your value really comes from growth assets, investments you're going to make in the future that I'm giving you credit for right now, even before you've thought about them. On the other side of the balance sheet, there are only two items again. You can either borrow money or you can use your own money. Now, in a publicly traded company, that might take the form of bonds or stocks, but basically, debt and equity are the only two ways of raising money. So financial balance sheet gives you a broader vision of a company, and in a sense a simpler vision of a company. In fact, the best way to illustrate a financial balance sheet is by showing you two very different companies. The first is Con Ed, a regulated utility. It's been around for a century. It provides electricity to New York City. It's regulated in the sense that its price increases are set by a commission, its earnings grow 3 or 4% a year. It's a mature company. On the other end of the spectrum, you got eBay, a company that came out of the dot-com e-commerce boom of the late 90s, one of the most successful examples of that boom, a company where the bulk of its value comes from investments in the future. In fact, let's take a closer look at these two companies. If you look at Con Ed, you will see that the bulk of its value comes from investments it's already made, assets in place, as I like to call them, which is just a fancy word for saying, these are investments that Con Ed made 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. They're worth about $15 billion from my estimate, and there are growth investments as well, but that are a relatively small slice of the company. In fact, I've been charitable and given them about a $3 billion value. So out of the $18 billion value, about 80% plus comes from assets in place, less than 20% comes from growth investments. On the other side of the balance sheet, you have the amount of debt and equity that Con Ed has, and you'll notice that they have a substantial amount of debt, $7 billion in debt, $11 billion in equity. So this firm is about 40% debt, 60% equity, which is not unusual for a mature company. Now you look at eBay, you see a very different financial balance sheet. About $6 billion in assets in place, investments already made, about $70 billion from growth assets. Scary thought, but when you buy eBay, that's what you're buying. You're buying investments in the future. And if you look at the other side of the balance sheet, very interesting contrast with Con Ed. Most of the funding for eBay comes from equity. In fact, it's almost all equity. There's a very, very tiny slice of debt. I think, in a sense, one of the more interesting ways to think about corporate finance is to relate it to the life cycle of a company. eBay is it's a very young firm. It's very early in the life cycle, and firms early in the life cycle tend to get most of their value from growth assets, tend to fund most of those assets from equity. For a very simple reason, they can't afford to carry debt. They can't make the interest payments and the principal payments of the debt from investments they haven't even thought about yet. And there's a closing thought. I mean, they don't exactly return a lot of cash to their stockholders. eBay, for instance, pays no dividends. Young companies fund most of their assets with equity, pay very little in dividends. That's one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got mature companies, get the bulk of their value from investments they've already made, fund them with a significant amount of debt. I wouldn't say predominantly with debt, but a significant amount of debt, and often tend to pay out fairly large dividends. I know stereotypes are dangerous, but they're useful. They give you a sense of what a typical company in the life cycle does, and it's an interesting way to frame where a company is in the life cycle. So with that background, let's think about what corporate finance is all about. As I see it, there are three basic principles that drive corporate finance. There's the investment principle. What is the investment principle? It says when you as a business go out and make investments, try to invest in assets, / projects, / new investments, whatever you want to call them, that earn a return that is greater than some minimum acceptable hurdle rate. Now that sounds like buzzwords, and it's a set of buzzwords. But here are the base principles that are going to govern what I mean by a hurdle rate. Every investment has a hurdle it has to cross. And that hurdle should be higher for riskier investments than for safer investments. Or put another way, if I came to you with a really safe investment, you might say, well, if I make more than 7%, that investment is fine. But if I come to you with a risky investment, you're going to demand 12, 14, you should demand 14, 15%. It's a riskier investment. The hurdle rate should reflect the risk of the investment. It should also reflect where you raise the money. After all, we said there were two ways of raising money, debt and equity. That mix of debt and equity should drive the hurdle rate as well. When you think about returns, the returns on an investment should be measured based on the cash flows on that investment. As opposed to what? As opposed to accounting earnings. Should reflect when the cash flows come in. Now, after all, cash flows early are worth more than the same cash flows later. And there's really no room for garnishing in investment analysis. Let me explain what I mean by this. In far too many investment analyses, you crunch through the numbers, you come up with a final number conclusion, but then somebody decides to override that. They say, well, this project looks bad on a financial basis, but we're going to take it anyway. And you've heard the buzzwords, the kinds of excuses that are used, strategic considerations, synergy. Now, I'm not arguing that those don't exist, but my point is if those exist, it's your job to bring them into the numbers rather than leave them out. So that's basically the investment principle. Find investments that earn a return greater than a minimum acceptable hurdle rate. Now, what does the financing principle say? The financing principle basically argues that when you try to decide the mix of debt and equity that's right for your company, you want to pick a mix of debt and equity that minimizes that hurdle rate. I mean, after all, it's better to have a 9% cost of funding than 11% cost of funding. And the type of debt you use should reflect the kinds of assets you have. In other words, if you have long-term assets, you should use long-term debt. It sounds simple, but that's what it is. So that's the financing principle. There's a third principle, and it's kind of a mop-up principle. It's a dividend principle. It says, look, if you can't find investments that make your hurdle rate, take the money out of the business. If it's a private business and you're the owner, take the money out. There's no law that says you got to keep reinvesting. If you're a publicly traded company, things get a little more complicated. You can't just take money out of the business. You got to return it to the stockholders either as dividends, the historic way in which companies have returned cash, or as stock buybacks. A more recent, you know, development, but some, you know, way in which you could return billions of dollars of cash back to your stockholders. And in doing all of this, you have a singular objective in corporate finance. You want to make your firm the most valuable firm, make your business the most valuable business you can. So let's lay some basic detail on these first principles. I mean, we won't have the time to talk about each of them in full detail, but at least the basic detail that you need. Let's start with the hurdle rate. Let's restate what we said earlier. The hurdle rate should be higher for riskier investments and lower for safer investments, which of course lays open the question, what do we mean by risk? How do we measure risk? While we don't have the models and the tools and the techniques all ready to go, we can lay out the principles that govern how we think about risk in finance at least. We think about risk, or we measure risk, through the eyes of the marginal investor in a business. You're saying, who the heck is a marginal investor? The marginal investor is the investor most likely to be setting prices on your company's stock, if you're a publicly traded company. Which, if you think about it, in most publicly traded companies will be somebody owns a lot of stock and trades that stock frequently, which will make it unlikely that it's going to be a founder owner of the company or you and I as small individual investors. It's probably more likely to be a Fidelity or a State Street or a Barclays, some kind of a institutional investor. We think about risk, we measure risk through their eyes, which is actually interesting because it means that when you analyze a company, you've got to look through the eyes of those marginal investors when you think about risk. When you manage a company, you've got to look through their eyes as well. The second sub-principle that's going to govern this notion of risk is we have to be consistent. If we say that two investments have the same risk, they should have the same hurdle rates. Because if they didn't, it wouldn't be right. There would be no consistency in this principle. So we're looking for a way of thinking about risk that looks at risk through the eyes of the marginal investor and evens out risk across investments. Now the second part of this, the hurdle rate principle, says that the mix of debt and equity somehow has to get reflected in the hurdle rate. And I think there are lots of ways of doing it, but I think the most sensible way of doing that is to look at what it costs you to borrow money, what it costs you to raise equity, and to take some kind of weighted average depending on how much of each you use. Okay? But the hurdle rate should reflect both the risk and the mix of debt and equity. Now the other side of the equation, of course, is the return side. Again, restating the principles from earlier, when we talk about returns, we're talking about cash flows. We're not talking about accounting earnings, and for a very simple reason. Cash flows are a clean way of thinking about returns. Accounting earnings are going to be subject to whatever discretionary choices you make as an accountant. And even somebody with just a basic accounting course knows that small changes in the way we define accounting expenses can move earnings around. So we're going to focus on cash flows. Because cash flows and earnings can be very different. When they are different, you want to trust the cash flows. The second is you want to wait in when those cash flows come in. Cash flows that come in earlier are worth more than the same cash flows later, which this is just a fancy way of saying that we've got to do some kind of discounting. I mean, after all, when we talk about present values and the time value of money, this is effectively what we're talking about. It's time weighting the cash flows. And third, we have to figure out some way to bring those qualitative concerns that that investors, managers, whoever it is, have about things like synergy and strategic considerations into the cash flows. We can't leave them outside the process and let them override the process. So the final return number that we're going to come up with is going to reflect cash flows. Is going to reflect the timing of those cash flows and have all side effects built into them. Let's talk a little bit about the financing principle. Again, two subparts to it. One is the mix of debt and equity. As I said, if there are only two ways of raising money, debt and equity, you've got to figure out how much of each you want to use. And we have to find a mix that kind of minimizes our overall cost of funding our business. Now, I'll state at the top, and this is going to sound surprising, that it's going to cost you far less to borrow money than it is to raise equity for a very simple reason. Debt comes with a tax advantage usually. Interest expenses are tax deductible, equity doesn't. But having said that, it doesn't necessarily follow that companies should be 100% debt. In fact, it turns out that the cost of funding is a fairly dynamic process. It's going to be different for different companies, and the mix that's going to give you the lowest cost is going to be different for different companies. It might be 50% for Con Ed and 10% for eBay, but it's going to reflect whether you can carry that debt as a company and pay the interest expenses associated with the debt. The second part of the principle, again, is a very simplistic one. You tell me what you're going to invest in, I'll tell you what the right kind of financing for your company is. You have a lot of long-term investments in Europe and your cash flows are all in euros. Well, the right kind of debt for you is probably long-term euro debt. Sounds incredibly simplistic, but it's actually a very effective way of thinking about how you should raise money for your business. Which brings us to the final principle. If you cannot find investments that make your hurdle rate, don't keep trying to invest. And if you cannot find investments and a lot of cash is coming in from your existing investments, you're going to be faced with a quandary. If you don't return the cash back to your owners, in this case publicly traded company or stockholders, you're going to accumulate a lot of cash in your company. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but cash balances do build up at companies. So one of the issues that every business has to face is how much cash is too much cash. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question because it really depends on how much you as stockholders trust the managers of the company. To the extent that you trust the managers of a company, you will let them accumulate cash because cash by itself is not a bad investment. It doesn't hurt anybody. It's what you're worried that managers will do with cash that potentially could hurt you. So one of the ways to think about the dividend principle is it's really an answer to the question of when do I have too much cash? When should I think about returning it to the stockholders? And when I choose to return it to the stockholders, should I pay dividends or should I buy back stock? At the risk of short-circuiting the process, the answer would really depend on what your stockholders like. If they like dividends, pay them dividends. If they prefer price appreciation, do stock buybacks. You say, how would I know that? Well, if you've paid a lot of dividends for 50 years, then odds are like Con Ed, you've attracted investors who like dividends. They're not going to change all of a sudden. So think about who your stockholders are, and you should have the answer as to what the right way of returning cash to your owners is. So the investment principle, the financing principle, and the dividend principle are the three basic principles that drive corporate finance. And corporate finance, as I said, has a singular objective: maximize the value of your business. Well, having said that, in practice, that objective is often narrowed to maximizing the wealth of stockholders, not the whole business. Remember, business is debt plus equity. It's the overall business. But since managers work for stockholders, they tend to think of stockholders first. And that gets narrowed even further as maximizing stock prices. In fact, when I learned corporate finance, my corporate finance textbook in chapter 1 said the objective in every decision is to maximize the stock price. Well, implicit there are some beliefs that we don't quite flesh out as corporate finance people. One belief is that we think markets are efficient, a belief that I will come back and contest later in this class where I think about what the right way to increase the value of a firm is. But if you believe that markets are efficient, when you maximize stock prices, you're maximizing the value of equity in your company because markets are efficient. They assess the value of your equity correctly. And we also implicitly assume that you don't do bad things to increase equity value. You're saying, what kind of bad things? Well, you can steal from your bondholders. I'm not saying it's the noblest thing in the world to do, but you could do it. So implicitly, corporate finance assumes that you're maximizing equity value by taking better investments, not by ripping off your bondholders. So when people talk about maximizing stock prices, they're using a much narrower objective function than traditional corporate finance, but they get away with it by making these implicit assumptions. So in a sense, corporate finance is not that complicated. You want to pick good investments, you want to fund them right, you want to pay the right amount in dividends, and in doing all of this, you want to get the most valuable business you can. In fact, much of what I've said, you probably already know. You don't even need a corporate finance class, and you know what? If you're not in corporate finance, that's all you might need. You might be done. You don't have to look at the rest of the stuff in this website on corporate finance. You're done. You can basically take those first principles and succeed with them. If you're a little curious and you want to explore further, you can either go into individual topics and explore them, or you can go into my background section of this site and look at just a short version of a corporate finance class. I have an executive version that's 4 sessions long or 6 sessions long, and try it out. If you like reading, I would suggest a book I like very much because I agree with the author most of the time. It happens to be my own book. It's called Applied Corporate Finance, which gives you my vision of corporate finance in about 350 to 400 pages. If you think that's too short, I have a longer vision that says the same thing in more verbose terms. It's called Corporate Finance, the book. And if you really have a lot of time in your hands, I don't know why you might have this much time, but if you do, you can take the entire corporate finance class I offer at NYU for free. And just don't let NYU know. There are 26 sessions, all webcast. You can go to the classes, click on corporate finance, go through the entire class. You can even take the quizzes and the exam if you feel like it. The video quality is not great in the webcast. No, I wouldn't pay money to Blockbuster, for instance, rent these videos. But the audio, I think, is fine. And if you have any questions, I'm always ready to answer those questions. Just don't make them really long and really involved. But I hope, more than anything else, that you enjoy corporate finance as much as I do. I think it's an incredibly creative, interesting area to be in. And it makes the world more understandable. You can see what people are doing, why they're doing it. And sometimes you can see when people are doing really stupid things ahead of time, and you can say, well, why are they doing that? I think the answers might lie in the fact that a lot of people don't think through the long-term consequences of what they're going to do. And a lot of people include a lot of very smart people at a lot of big corporations and a lot of big investment banks. But I hope you have fun. And thank you very much for listening to this webcast. Bye.